Good morning, good people. I'm Kipling Primus, your host for The Local Take on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. And this morning, we're talking with Basi Ikpe, a Nigerian-American poet and author. And her new book, I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, is due out in the month of August. Basi, thanks so much for joining us on The Local Take.
Thank you for having me.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is that your book of essays, I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, is more of a narrative, and it seems completely different from the poetry that we know you from, your spoken word work. Can you tell us, did you have a different approach, and did these things seem different to you?
You mean between poetry and the collection?
Correct.
Yes. Not really. I think that even though I don't really consider myself a poet anymore, that muscle doesn't really go away. So the way that I think is in very like short sentences, very descriptive short sentences and lines. And a lot of the way I've learned to express myself as a writer came from when I was writing poetry. So when I, you know, was writing the book and thinking about the ways I wanted to express certain emotions or situations, that poetry, you know, instinct kicked in. But because it's longer form writing, I had a lot more space to work through all of it.
So the creative process for you was pretty much the same, and you work with words. So whether it's poetry or essays, did you find that that made telling, you know, your story easier, or was it more difficult to find the words to tell your own story?
I'll say that the way that I approached the writing when I first started writing the book made things very difficult because I was doing my best to quote unquote write differently. I'd read books, you know, memoir, I'd read essay collections, I'd read books about mental health, and they were all written a certain way. And I think that I unconsciously wanted to mimic that way. And it wasn't until I gave myself full permission to tell the story, my story, the way that it needed to be told as opposed to the way that it was supposed to be told. That gave me a lot more freedom in how I approached everything. For instance, some of the essays are written in different perspectives, like within the same essay. Like I switch between first and second person. There are essays that are entirely written in third person. And those are to mimic the ways that a lot of the situations that I was explaining show up in people's lives. The way that you can feel sort of disconnected from your body and almost like you're watching yourself from the outside. And in order for me to properly convey that, I had to tell the story as though I were watching myself from the outside. And that's not something that's usually done in nonfiction work. I use a lot of fiction principles to write this book. So I actually consider it a collection of nonfiction short stories. I think that's a lot more accurate. I was in a writing workshop that Chimamanda Adichie held, and I was telling her, like, I don't write fiction. And she was like, there's the only difference between fiction and nonfiction is a fact check. That's really the only thing. You tell stories the exact same way, or should.
I think that is a very interesting perspective, and it really does, you know, make sense. Now, your story has always embraced mental health. You've always spoken out about it. It's almost always been your platform, almost since you entered the, you know, the general culture, so to speak. But in your work, it doesn't sound preachy. It's not judgmental, but it also isn't romanticized. How does your approach to discussing mental health and mental health challenges, you know, differ from the current cultural narrative?
I think it's one of there's several directions, but the main two directions that people usually take The first is like the self-help, right, where you tell the story, but you emphasize, you know, whatever healing thing, whether it be God or yoga or, you know, whatever that helps you on the other side. So now you're looking back and trying to tell people, you know, what they should do in their lives, right? There's one way. And then the other way is the way that Fuller Street, the one that's very, very clinical, very full of facts and figures and statistics and all these numbers that detach people from the things that we're speaking about. And then another way is what I call trauma porn, where you're just the worst possible way you could tell the story and wring as much trauma out of it as you possibly can. And none of those experiences are true to what I've lived. I've, you know, very fortunate to have family that didn't, you know, throw me out or shun me or try to convince me that I wasn't ill or it wasn't real. But at the same time, they didn't 100% understand what was going on. I think the best way to get people to connect to your story is to tell the story in a way that feel like they can see themselves or their loved ones or even people that they work with that they don't like in there. So that ability to cultivate empathy from a story that seems very, very personal on the surface, but when you look deeper, it's about that interconnectedness that we all feel when it comes to emotion and loneliness and despair and triumph and all these different facets of it. And I never wanted it to look as though, I never wanted it to be as though, A, that I 100% have it all figured out, but then it's not like I'm all the way down either. The book actually ends with, this is an ongoing thing. I will be having to deal with things like this for the rest of my life. And I'm aware of that. And I want you to be aware that the happy ending here is the fact that we're still alive and we're still living.
In one of your essays, you used the phrase, you know, everything was good until it wasn't.
Right.
And can you just expound a little bit on that? Because so often people who are dealing with mental health challenges have no idea that it is a challenge. It seems like this is the way it's always been. This is the way, you know, my mom handled problems. This is the way my family handles problems. So this is the way I'm going to handle a problem. And they don't realize that it really isn't all right.
Yeah. I think that refrain is about, I know for me personally that a lot of what I thought was my personality were actually symptoms of this undiagnosed thing that I had. I thought that I was someone who functioned on very little sleep. I like to, you know, go out and hang out and spend a lot of time with my friends and I spent a lot of money. Like the running joke was that I just, you know, would go on these shopping sprees and, you know, I spoke fast and just all these different things that you think are your personality. And once people leave and you're left with yourself and you realize, okay, I haven't slept in a couple of days. I haven't eaten in a couple of days. And the natural biological toll that takes on your body and the way that it skews the way you see the world and things around you. So one of the things that you use to like propel you through the day and move you through your life and all the things that people say they love about you, when you're left alone with them, they're a lot more heavier once you sit still, once you stand still, once you're able to try and make sense of the things that keep moving without your permission. And I think that's one of the things that, especially as Black people, we tend to, especially as Black women, we strong Black women ourselves to death, and we feel as though not feeling good is part of our birthright. And to know and to understand that, you know, turmoil and strife and pain are not things that are attached to us. And once we stop getting used to this idea that we're supposed to feel bad, I think it definitely helps us figure out how to process the things that happen and notice, like right now, because of all the treatment that I've been through, you know, the last couple of years, I know when I don't feel well. Over the weekend, I was feeling a bit sluggish, and I know to catch those things. When I start feeling like I can't sleep and I'm up a little later than I need to be, I know that I can catch those things and call somebody and call my doctor or just make some minor adjustments in order to make myself go back on track. And I think that once we taste, you know, what it feels like to be better, and you start paying attention to those things, you're able to sort of suss out what's a natural part of who you are and what's been put on you.
Now, and you mentioned Black women, and that just brings me right to your nonprofit, the Seaway Project, which focuses on people from the African diaspora, wherever they are, and mental health. Do you think mental health is different for people of African descent than the general population?
I anecdotally, I say yes. I think that our relationship to our mental health and our emotional health is different because of the things I mentioned before, which is we think that hardship is part of our history, and going through, you know, or knowing that, you know, your grandmother had, you know, 7 children and she never cried, but she never slept, and she never did, you know, all these things that we know to encapsulate what makes us happy or what makes us content in the world. And we think that because somebody else has suffered, that suffering is part of who we are. And it runs the gamut, because, you know, I'm Nigerian by birth, and the way that I see Nigerian women speak about their relationship to their happiness and their contentment is the way that I see a lot of, you know, Black Americans do the same thing. Like, there's something about the way that we've been oriented in this world that has given us this false impression that we're not entitled to our happiness. I think that I've seen a lot of it change over the last couple of years, but there's still a level of, if you can't handle this by yourself, then it's wrong, as opposed to there's something wrong and I can't handle it by myself and I need some extra help. There's also this element that runs again in all Black populations all over the world, or the diaspora, which is that we don't want to air our dirty laundry. Like, whatever it is that you have to hold it. You can't tell other people what it is. You can't let it go outside the door. We all have versions of the quote-unquote crazy aunt or uncle who nobody talks about, but everybody knows that there's something going on with them. And that's universal in the diaspora. So, yeah, there's definitely something different. I think that white folks specifically are a bit more open to internal searches of self and always trying to find themselves and find the thing that makes them happy and discuss it and talk about it. I think they have more access to that, whereas we've been conditioned to think that our problems aren't enough. One of the things that I was very, very firm about in this book is that I refuse to tie my story into any, you know, larger socio-political story. This isn't a story about the way that, you know, racism affects Black people. It's not about, you know, anything like that. It's about knowing that our individual stories are just as important as anybody else's individual stories, and those individual stories are the ties that bind us. There are things within our stories that we can all connect to, but we can't dismiss how important our own personal narratives are.
You're reminding me of an anecdote where, you know, a white person has a car accident and it's a car accident. A Black person has a car accident and it's, you know, God trying to tell me I need
yes.
to, you know, or it's a generational
yes.
curse. We aren't supposed yes. to have cars.
Yes, that's word for word what you would say to me in Nigeria. That's word for word. It's a generational curse. It's true.
I think that is amazing that it is throughout the diaspora, that it doesn't matter where you grow up, that this is part of the culture of having Black skin on the planet. And wow, we need to change that.
Absolutely. I think we'd be much better for it. And I've seen the tide change over the last decade. So I'm really looking forward to the future generations. I think that they're really grasping this idea that their self-care and self-worth are just as important as any other, you know, larger familial or cultural, issue or element.
Some of us don't take the time to be physically ill. I've met people mm-hmm. with disease, and it really does seem as if they've just made up their mind, you know, I'm not yeah. going to acknowledge this disease. I'm just going to keep on moving. And it's the same with mental health. And I think we still don't quite understand or comprehend how the two things go hand in hand, what they're now calling integrative health, that you have to be mentally healthy, you know, to be physically healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're so connected. I think that it's almost a misnomer to call it mental health. Like, it is health. it is 100% your health. I know, again, when I'm not feeling okay, there are certain aches and pains. I think that a lot of us, have you ever seen somebody, you know, who looks decades older than their age? Like, you find out that they're 53, but they look like they're 73, and they walk like they're 73. Their bodies are almost like just aging rapidly. And when you think about, and when you talk to them, they have, you know, valid physical aches and pains. But if you would dig deeper, you know that a lot of those aches and pains are connected to how they feel emotionally. And once you get some of those, you know, things sorted out, and then you can treat the things that happen to the physical body. I think I wish that they went in for your yearly checkup at the doctor, your yearly physical, that there was also a mental health check as well, because so many of the things that we try to deal with surgeries and I don't want to say medication, because medication is part of it, but definitely, like, you know, it's physical, it's painful. A lot of that tension and stress that we carry shows up on our bodies.
I think you're right. And you mentioned medication, and that's another part of the mental health challenge to me. It's because people, you know, they might feel like they can pray and, you know, stress will go away, or I'll exercise until I feel better. But why that resistance to taking medication and then, you know, working with your practitioner to get the dosage right? You know, a lot of times people might start and then they say, well, you know, I don't really like it. It doesn't make me feel good, or it makes me feel this way as well as making me feel good. What is that resistance in our culture towards using, you know, 21st century medicine to help with anxiety, to help with depression?
I think it goes back to this idea that it's a weakness. There's something you're not doing. You're not trying hard enough. You're not praying hard enough. And one of the things I like to tell people when they mention, especially religion, and I say, look, if it were as easy as praying it away, I would be on my knees 24 hours a day in a church every day trying to figure out what the right combination of prayers to say to make it go away. This idea that somebody isn't working enough, or they're not connected enough to a higher power or higher source is the issue, is part of this idea that it's a weakness or a spiritual defect in some way. And I'm not to say, it's not to say that prayer or you know, a spiritual practice doesn't help, because it does help, especially when it comes to anxiety, being able to still yourself enough to pray and being able to sort of find some sort of peace within you to get to the next part where you do something about it. A lot of that comes with this generational idea that it's weakness, that it's a personality defect, it's a spiritual defect, it's something broken that you're not working hard enough to fix. But at the same time, I tell people that you take painkillers when your head hurts. If you broke a bone in your body, and barring any addiction issues, if you were offered painkillers to help you get to the point where you can now go forward with a physical therapy, something that helps you work out, you know, regain control of your limbs or helping with the muscle growth or what have you, you would do that. And it's the same thing for the way that your brain works. Your brain is an organ. Your brain is one of the biggest, most powerful organs in your, not the biggest, I don't know, guys, but one, it's one that's very important. It controls so many things. So to leave that unattended or to think that you can think through something that's affecting your brain, I think the more that we talk about these things and show people how connected they are to everything that you do, and what your brain is capable of doing, it'll help. But I definitely think it comes from this idea that it's a spiritual or some sort of moral failing on your part.
Now, I have followed you on Twitter since old Twitter. And on social media, you always share. You know, you share when you're having a good day. You share when you're having a bad day. How has that helped in your recovery and in your mental health?
It holds me accountable. I don't share nearly as much as I used to because social media has changed over the years. And one of the things I like to impart in people is that you take care of yourself first. So if it's not safe for you or comfortable for you to share, then you don't have to share. Like, it's not a requirement. But it holds me accountable. I know that I have friends who, if they see me up and tweeting a mile a minute at 3 o'clock in the morning, they'll check in on me, like, what's going on? Are you good? Do you need a med adjustment? Like, what's happening with you? And I'm able to check in with myself. I'm like, oh, you know what? I did have a couple of nights where it took me a while to fall asleep, and I felt like I needed to get these ideas out really quickly. So it's a self-check for me, and it's also why I started sharing in the first place, was because I felt so alone and so in my head and so disconnected from other people and what they were going through, that I selfishly wanted someone else to say, oh my gosh, I feel like that too, or I know what that is, or I recognize and understand that. And that's been the best part of it. And again, like I said, over the years, I've tapered down on it because, you know, people can just be mean just for the sake of being mean. And at the end of the day, it's not worth it for me to put myself through that. But initially it is just that connectedness and knowing that there's a community of people who, if they don't understand, they have a way of trying to find a way to understand and support. And that's really important. It's really important going through some of these things.
Well, Bossy, I want to thank you so much for the way that you have shared your story and the way that you support mental health for the African diaspora. And you are going to be here in Atlanta on September 11th at Karis Bookstore through the Art Exchange to do a reading and a book signing for I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying. I just want to thank you so much for all of that you do and for all of the sharing. And I know you can be found everywhere on social media at Bossy, which is B-A-S-S-E-Y.
Bossy World, yes.
Bossy World. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for facilitating this conversation. I think the medium that you have to reach so many people is really, really powerful. So thank you for taking the time to do that.
Anytime you need to get something out, just give us a call. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.